THE MOON POOL by A. Merritt. Chapter 5. Into the Moon Pool. "Goodwin," Throckmorton went on at last, "I can describe him only as a thing of living light. He radiated light, was filled with light, overflowed with it. A shining cloud whirled through and around him in radiant swirls, shimmering tentacles, luminescent coruscating spirals. His face shone with a rapture too great to be borne by living man, and was shadowed with insuperable misery. It was as though it had been remolded by the hand of God and the hand of Satan, working together and in harmony. You have seen that seal upon my own. But you have never seen it in the degree that Stanton bore it. The eyes were wide open and fixed, as though upon some inward vision of hell and heaven. The light that filled and surrounded him had a nucleus, a core, something shiftingly human-shaped, that dissolved and changed, gathered itself, whirled through and beyond him, and back again. And as its shining nucleus passed through him, Stanton's whole body pulsed radiance. As the luminescence moved, there moved above it, still and serene always, seven tiny globes of seven colors, like seven little moons. Then swiftly Stanton was lifted, levitated, up the unscalable wall and to its top. The glow faded from the moonlight. The tinkling music grew fainter. I tried again to move. The tears were running down now from my rigid lids, and they brought relief to my tortured eyes. I have said my gaze was fixed. It was. But from the side, peripherally, it took in a part of the far wall of the outer enclosure. Ages seemed to pass, and a radiance stole along it. Soon drifted into sight the figure that was Stanton. Far away he was, on the gigantic wall. But still I could see the shining spirals whirling jubilantly around and through him, felt rather than saw his tranced face beneath the seven moons. A swirl of crystal notes, and he had passed. And all the time, as though from some opened well of light, the courtyard gleamed and sent out silver fires that dimmed the moon rays, yet seemed strangely to be part of them. At last the moon neared the horizon. There came a louder burst of sound. The second and last cry of Stanton, like an echo of his first. Again the soft sighing from the inner terrace. Then utter silence. The light faded. The moon was setting. And with a rush, life and power to move returned to me. I made a leap for the steps, rushed up them, through the gateway, and straight to the gray rock. It was closed, as I knew it would be. But did I dream it, or did I hear, echoing through it as though from vast distances, a triumphant shouting? I ran back to Edith. At my touch she wakened, looked at me wonderingly, raised herself on a hand. "Dave," she said, "I slept after all." She saw the despair on my face and leapt to her feet. "Dave," she cried, "what is it? Where's Charles?" I lighted a fire before I spoke. Then I told her. And for the balance of that night we sat before the flames, arms around each other, like two frightened children. Abruptly, Throckmorton held his hands out to me appealingly. "Walter, old friend," he cried, "don't look at me as though I were mad. It's truth, absolute truth. Wait!" I comforted him as well as I could. After a little time, he took up his story. "Never," he said, "did man welcome the sun as we did that morning. As soon as it had risen, we went back to the courtyard. The walls whereon I had seen Stanton were black and silent. The terraces were as they had been. The gray slab was in its place. In the shallow hollow at its base was nothing. Nothing. Nothing was there anywhere on the islet of Stanton. Not a trace. What were we to do? Precisely the same arguments that had kept us there the night before held good now, and doubly good. We could not abandon these two, could not go as long as there was the faintest hope of finding them. And yet, for love of each other, how could we remain? I loved my wife. How much I never knew until that day. And she loved me as deeply. It takes only one each night, she pleaded. Beloved, let it take me. I wept, Walter. We both wept. We will meet it together, she said. And it was thus at last that we arranged it.
That took great courage indeed, Throckmorton, I interrupted.
He looked at me eagerly. You do believe, then? He exclaimed.
I believe, I said.
He pressed my hand with a grip that nearly crushed it. Now, he told me, I do not fear. If I fail, you will follow with help?
I promised.
We talked it over carefully, he went on, bringing to bear all our power of analysis and habit of calm scientific thought. We considered minutely the time element in the phenomena. Although the deep chanting began at the very moment of moonrise, fully 5 minutes had passed between its full lifting and the strange sighing sound from the inner terrace. I went back, in memory, over the happenings of the night before. At least 10 minutes had intervened between the first heralding sigh and the intensification of the moonlight in the courtyard. And this glow grew for at least 10 minutes more before the first burst of the crystal notes. Indeed, more than half an hour must have elapsed, I calculated, between the moment the moon showed above the horizon and the first delicate onslaught of the tinklings. Edith! I cried. I think I have it! The gray rock opens 5 minutes after, upon the moonrise. But whoever or whatever it is that comes through it must wait until the moon has risen higher, or else it must come from a distance. The thing to do is not to wait for it, but to surprise it before it passes out the door. We will go into the inner court early. You will take your rifle and pistol and hide yourself where you can command the opening. If the slab does open. The instant it opens, I will enter. It's our best chance, Edith. I think it's our only one. My wife demurred strongly. She wanted to go with me. But I convinced her that it was better for her to stand guard without, prepared to help me if I were forced again into the open by what lay behind the rock. At the half hour before moonrise, we went into the inner court. I took my place at the side of the gray rock. Edith crouched behind a broken pillar 20 feet away. Slipped her rifle barrel over it so that it would cover the opening. The minutes crept by. The darkness lessened, and through the breaches of the terrace I watched the far sky softly lighten. With the first pale flush, the silence of the place intensified. It deepened, became unbearably expectant. The moon rose, showed the quarter, the half, then swam up into full sight like a great bubble. Its rays fell upon the wall before me, and suddenly, upon the convexities I have described, seven little circles of light sprang out. They gleamed, glimmered, grew brighter, shone. The gigantic slab before me glowed with them. Silver wavelets of phosphorescence pulsed over its surface, and then it turned as though on a pivot, sighing softly as it moved. With a word to Edith, I flung myself through the opening. A tunnel stretched before me. It glowed with the same faint silvery radiance. Down it I raced. The passage turned abruptly, passed parallel to the walls of the outer courtyard, and then once more led downward. The passage ended. Before me was a high vaulted arch. It seemed to open into space, a space filled with lambent, coruscating, many-colored mist, whose brightness grew even as I watched. I passed through the arch and stopped, in sheer awe. In front of me was a pool. It was circular, perhaps 20 feet wide. Around it ran a low, softly curved lip of glimmering silvery stone. Its water was palest blue. The pool, with its silvery rim, was like a great blue eye staring upward. Upon it streamed seven shafts of radiance. They poured down upon the blue eye like cylindrical torrents. They were like shining pillars of light rising from a sapphire floor. One was the tender pink of the pearl, one of the aurora's green, a third a deathly white, the fourth the blue in mother of pearl, a shimmering column of pale amber, a beam of amethyst, a shaft of molten silver. Such are the colors of the seven lights that stream upon the moon pool. I drew closer, awe-stricken. The shafts did not illumine the depths. They played upon the surface and seemed there to diffuse, to melt into it. The pool drank them? Through the water, tiny gleams of phosphorescence began to dart, sparkles and coruscations of pale incandescence. And far, far below, I sensed a movement, a shifting glow, as of a radiant body slowly rising. I looked upward, following the radiant pillars to their source. Far above were seven shining globes, and it was from these that the rays poured. Even as I watched, their brightness grew. They were like seven moons set high in some caverned heaven. Slowly their splendor increased, and with it the splendor of the seven beams streaming from them. I tore my gaze away and stared at the pool. It had grown milky, opalescent. The rays gushing into it seemed to be filling it. It was alive with sparklings, scintillations, glimmerings, and the luminescence I had seen rising from its depths was larger, nearer. A swirl of mist floated up from its surface. It drifted within the embrace of the rosy beam and hung there a moment. The beam seemed to embrace it, sending through it little shining corpuscles, tiny rosy spiralings. The mist absorbed the rays, was strengthened by them, gained substance. Another swirl sprang into the amber shaft, clung and fed there, moved swiftly toward the first and mingled with it. And now other swirls arose here and there, too fast to be counted, hung poised in the embrace of the light streams, flashed and pulsed into each other. Thicker and thicker still they arose, until over the surface of the pool was a pulsating pillar of opalescent mist steadily growing stronger, drawing within it life from the seven beams falling upon it, drawing to it from below the darting incandescent atoms of the pool. Into its center was passing the luminescence rising from the far depths, and the pillar glowed, throbbed, began to send out questing swirls and tendrils. There, forming before me, was that which had walked with Stanton, which had taken Thora. The thing I had come to find! My brain sprang into action. My hand threw up the pistol, and I fired shot after shot into the shining core. As I fired, it swayed and shook, gathered again. I slipped a second clip into the automatic, and another idea coming to me, took careful aim at one of the globes in the roof. From thence I knew came the force that shaped this dweller in the pool. From the pouring rays came its strength. If I could destroy them, I could check its forming. I fired again and again. If I hit the globes, I did no damage. The little motes in their beams danced with the motes in the mist, troubled. That was all. But up from the pool, like little bells, like tiny bursting bubbles of glass, swarmed the tinkling sounds, their pitch higher, all their sweetness lost, angry. And out from the inexplicable swept a shining spiral. It caught me above the heart, wrapped itself around me. There rushed through me a mingled ecstasy and horror. Every atom of me quivered with delight and shrank with despair. There was nothing loathsome in it. But it was as though the icy soul of evil and the fiery soul of good had stepped together within me. The pistol dropped from my hand. So I stood, while the pool gleamed and sparkled, the streams of light grew more intense, and the radiant thing that held me gleamed and strengthened. Its shining core had shape, but a shape that my eyes and brain could not define. It was as though a being of another sphere should assume what it might of human semblance, but was not able to conceal that what human eyes saw was but a part of it. It was neither man nor woman. It was unearthly and androgynous. Even as I found its human semblance, it changed. And still the mingled rapture and terror held me. Only in a little corner of my brain dwelt something untouched, something that held itself apart and watched. Was it the soul? I have never believed, and yet... Over the head of the misty body there sprang suddenly out seven little lights. Each was the color of the beam beneath which it rested. I knew now that the dweller was complete. I heard a scream. It was Edith's voice. It came to me that she had heard the shots and followed me. I felt every faculty concentrate into a mighty effort. I wrenched myself free from the gripping tentacle, and it swept back. I turned to catch Edith, and as I did so, slipped, fell. The radiant shape above the pool leaped swiftly, and straight into it raced Edith, arms outstretched to shield me from it. God! She threw herself squarely within its splendor. He whispered. It wrapped its shining self around her. The crystal tinklings burst forth jubilantly. The light filled her, ran through and around her, as it had with Stanton, and dropped down upon her face. The look! But her rush had taken her to the very verge of the moon pool. She tottered, she fell, with the radiance still holding her, still swirling and winding around and through her, into the moon pool! She sank, and with her went the dweller. I dragged myself to the brink. Far down was a shining, many-colored, nebulous cloud descending. Out of it peered Edith's face, disappearing. Her eyes stared up at me, and she vanished. "Edith!" I cried again. "Edith, come back to me!" And then a darkness fell upon me. I remember running back through the shimmering corridors and out into the courtyard. Reason had left me. When it returned, I was far out at sea in our boat, wholly estranged from civilization. A day later, I was picked up by the schooner in which I came to Port Moresby. "I have formed a plan. You must hear it, Goodwin." He fell upon his berth. I bent over him. Exhaustion and the relief of telling his story had been too much for him. He slept like the dead. All that night I watched over him. When dawn broke, I went to my room to get a little sleep myself, but my slumber was haunted. The next day the storm was unabated. Throckmorton came to me at lunch. He had regained much of his old alertness. "Come to my cabin," he said. There he stripped his shirt from him. "Something is happening," he said. "The mark is smaller." It was as he said. "I'm escaping," he whispered jubilantly. "Just let me get to Melbourne safely, and then we'll see who will win. For Walter, I'm not at all sure that Edith is dead, as we know death, nor that the others are. There is something outside experience there, some great mystery." And all that day he talked to me of his plans. "There's a natural explanation, of course," he said. "My theory is that the moon rock is of some composition sensitive to the action of moon rays, somewhat as the metal selenium is to sun rays. The little circles over the top are, without doubt, its operating agency. When the light strikes them, they release the mechanism that opens the slab, just as you can open doors with sun or electric light by an ingenious arrangement of selenium cells. Apparently, it takes the strength of the full moon both to do this and to summon the dweller in the pool. We will first try a concentration of the rays of the waning moon upon those circles to see whether that will open the rock. If it does, we will be able to investigate the pool without interruption from what emanates. Look, here on the chart are their locations. I have made this in duplicate for you in the event of something happening to me. And if I lose, you'll come after us, Goodwin, with help, won't you?" And again I promised. A little later he complained of increasing sleepiness. "But it's just weariness," he said. "Not at all like that other drowsiness. It's an hour till moonrise still." He yawned at last. "Wake me up a good 15 minutes before." He lay upon the berth. I sat thinking. I came to myself with a guilty start. I had completely lost myself in my deep preoccupation. What time was it? I looked at my watch and jumped to the porthole. It was full moonlight. The orb had been up for fully half an hour. I strode over to Throckmorton and shook him by the shoulder. "Up, quick man!" I cried. He rose sleepily. His shirt fell open at the neck, and I looked in amazement at the white band around his chest. Even under the electric light it shone softly, as though little flecks of light were in it. Throckmorton seemed only half awake. He looked down at his breast, saw the glowing cincture, and smiled.
"Yes," he said drowsily. "It's coming to take me back to Edith. Well, I'm glad."
"Throckmorton," I cried, "wake up! Fight!"
"Fight?" he said. "No use. Come after us."
He went to the port and sleepily drew aside the curtain. The moon traced a broad path of light straight to the ship. Under its rays, the band around his chest gleamed brighter and brighter, shot forth little rays, seemed to writhe. The lights went out in the cabin. Evidently also throughout the ship, for I heard shoutings above. Throckmorton still stood at the open port. Over his shoulder I saw a gleaming pillar racing along the moon path toward us. Through the window cascaded a blinding radiance. It gathered Throckmorton to it, clothed him in a robe of living opalescence. Light pulsed through and from him. The cabin filled with murmurings. A wave of weakness swept over me, buried me in blackness. When consciousness came back, the lights were again burning brightly. But of Throckmorton there was no trace. End of chapter 5.